When the fire department comes in, folks need to be helped to the bathroom. But what a service it always is, bursting with life, brimming with power, bubbling with joy. This year, Nesta, short, stocky Nesta, who has joyfully worked at overcoming her disabilities, sings us a swaying, passionate solo. It's Charles Albert Tindley's classic, "Take Your Burden to the Lord and Leave It There." She uses no book. She can't really read. But one look at her face and you know. She sings from the heart. "If the world from you withhold," she sings, "of its silver and its gold." And then Miss Clark, an elderly white visitor, asks if she too can share a song. It takes her frail, white-haired body a long time to make its way to the front. But when she gets there, when she gets her arms around something to hold on to, her foot begins thumping, and you can tell it's going to be good. In glorious tone, she takes off in a firm and soaring Appalachian style, singing, "There's healing in the word, there's healing in the word of God." What a song, what a voice, what a woman. A few hours later, I board a train for a conference in Indianapolis. The sun is setting as we pull through the lush mountains west of White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. It's as if the whole outside world is conspiring to keep alive the memory of this morning. A rushing stream twists its way alongside the tracks. Its racing waters shimmer with the blue-gray rose of the sky and vivid early summer green of the surrounding hills. Flowers of every hue dot its banks. But inside the train, reality reigns. Behind me sit two whining girls and their harried mother. "Megan, sit back and look out the window." "But Allie has my book. Allie, give Megan her book." A piercing scream as the book is yanked from one pair of hands to the next. "She put crud all over it. I did not. You did too." Oblivious to this commotion, the train pulls into the tiny town of Alderson, West Virginia. And my spirit is caught in contradictions. The glories of this morning worship service still live, but they are torn by the cries and screams of the girls behind me, now furiously beating on each other in a vain effort to regain the attentions of their now silent and sullen mother. And outside, the quiet peace of these God-drenched hills is clouded by the knowledge that somewhere, somewhere in this remote mountain village, stands a federal penitentiary, the largest women's prison in the United States. And I'm reminded of Jesus' promise to set the captives free. And I wonder how much longer we must wait, how much longer we must work till the walls come tumbling down. As the train pauses at the little station in Alderson, West Virginia, the door at the end of the coach opens. Four children, chattering happily in both English and Spanish, push their way down the aisle. They're followed by two stout, brown-skinned women lugging a pair of large, heavy suitcases. One is dressed in yellow, the other in a black and white polka dot jumpsuit. They're Puerto Rican. They gather in the seats beside and ahead of me. The children are young, perhaps 6 to 10. Their tickets read Chicago. As the train glides out of the little station and into the setting sun, all six move quickly to the window. "I know where my mama is," says the little girl next to me. A bright smile spreads across her face. A small cloth doll, dressed in homemade garments, rests in the crook of her arm. "She's right up on that mountain." I gulp and strain to see. Yet I don't want to see. Why must I be reminded of our horrible compulsion to lock people away? Why must I know again the terror that won't be broken? Our train slips past the faded houses of Alderson. Their tiny lights chip away at the gathering darkness. Hills rise on our right and left. Then suddenly, far up, an imposing brick and stone structure looms through the trees. Alderson Federal Penitentiary. "Look, Carlos," the little girl cries. "There it is, there it is." Inwardly, I'm weeping. The little girl is beaming. Indeed, utter joy rings her face. She leans her head back, clapping her hands with a lightness and a reverence befitting the specialness of this last glimpse, this final viewing of the fortress which your mother must call home. Seconds later, it's gone. The ruby-colored clouds fade, and the prison disappears from view. With renewed vengeance, the two children and the harried mother behind me resume their pitching and fighting. But Angelina, Carlos, and the others from Chicago slowly take their longing eyes from the window. As they sit back in their seats, a great peace seems to wrap itself around them. I'm baffled at their response. No tears, no sorrow, no anger at a world gone awry. How deeply they have been sinned against, yet here is peace, maybe prophetic peace. As Angelina leans back, clasping her doll close to her chest, I'm stunned by her tattered t-shirt. On the front of it, it says, "Somebody loves me in West Virginia." The train rolls on. I realize that Angelina isn't waiting. She can't wait for the walls of that prison to come tumbling down. For her, they already have. For her, no bars can seal out love. No cells can seal out that power which is stronger than death. No prison can keep Angelina and her mama from knowing the oneness of heart that God has put in their souls. When next I look around, Angelina and her brother have fallen asleep across their seats, their little bodies twisted and intertwined, arms wrapped around each other's shoulders. The frantic mother behind me is still desperately trying to separate her bawling offspring. My memories of this morning's church service again flood my soul. I think of Nesta. I think of Miss Clark. There is healing in the Word, healing in the freeing, liberating Word of God. Even when the pains are still with us, even when the sorrows are still great, it lifts our burdens, it heals our souls, it overcomes the world. But if only we could live more fully, more consistently, even now, in the power of that hope, in the vision of Jesus to change our world, how much more joy we could find. I wanted to talk about prisons, and I know that Al here has been talking about prisons for several days and has maybe given a lot of us here more than we even want to know about prisons. Prisons are not a happy subject. But I was tempted when I learned that he was coming not to talk about prisons because too much, you know. But prisons are something that have bothered me and something that I've struggled with for a long time. I have anguished with people who have been sentenced to prison, people whose brothers or children have been sent to prison. I've visited people in prison and written to people in prison. And it's just such an awful thing. The first article that I wrote for The Other Side, which is published about 18 years ago now, was about prisons. I've written many since, including one in this issue, which is over in the bookstore, called The God Who Dared, that I would especially recommend to you. But it's a difficult subject to deal with because there's so much pain involved. But I just want to begin by giving a little overview of what our situation is in the country. And you may have heard some of these things before or from sessions with Al. But in case you haven't, I want to go over it. Back in 1983, we had in this country 200 per 100,000 of our population behind bars. In prisons. Now, that's not counting jails and other detention centers. Currently, counting all those things, we have about 1 million, approximately, people who are in some kind of confinement. In 1983, 200 per 100,000. By 1990, it's expected to be 263 per 100,000. So the proportion of our population that we're imprisoning is growing. When you compare the imprisonment rate to in 1990, as it's expected to be, 263, to other industrialized countries, Austria, 114, West Germany, 100, England, 87, Netherlands, 28, Soviet Union, this was in 87, 193, Libya, that terrible country, 131. For rates higher than the U.S., you can find them too. You can look in places like El Salvador and South Korea and places like that.
South Africa too.
I've read that some places. There seems to be some debate about that. But and you know that many people are predicting a doubling of our jail cells by the end of this decade. I think maybe even George Bush made it a promise. What always happens is that every new cell is filled within a short length of time. If that were to happen, and the imprisonment rate were to double by 1999 or at the end of this century, we could be up to 530 per 100,000 imprisoned. Some of those people who investigate I'm going to pass on that because I'm not going to have enough time if I go into all of this. We also have within that 1 million people that we have in our nation who are currently, right now, in some kind of confinement, a lot of those folks have never been, of course, convicted yet of a crime. There was a Bail Reform Act passed in 1984, told. And it was supposed to allow the courts to selectively keep certain violent criminals in prison, denying bail prior to trial. And it was said that it would just apply to a very small number of people. Actually, it's sort of a preventative detention, in a sense, before trial. And that is now being employed, I'm told, in 29% of all criminal cases. And approximately half of those who are imprisoned under this preventative detention are ultimately acquitted, but have already served months and months, in many cases, in prison. There's also, of course, a strong racial dimension to our imprisonment. You know that African Americans at the last census were about 11% of our overall population. In 1930, African Americans were 23% of our prison population. In 1980, it had grown to 44%. And expectations are that in the 1990 figures, it will be at 50%. Incarceration rates for our African Americans are 6 times that of whites. 1 in 4 African American males will be jailed or imprisoned at least once during his life, many of them more than once. A black male, this is a figure that I found astounding, a black male in the United States is twice as likely to go to prison as a black male in South Africa. Hispanics are imprisoned at twice the rate of their proportion in the population. And for American Indian males, 1 in 3.5 will be behind bars during some time in their life. According to a study by the American Civil Liberties Union, non-whites in our country receive sentences 30% more severe than whites for identical offenses. People of color are 25% less likely than whites to receive early parole. And though whites are convicted of two-thirds of all capital crimes, half of the people on death row are black. I have a friend who is in prison in Texas. For many years, I've had him writing articles for the side. He's a marvelous writer. His name is Philip Rassfield. An article he wrote for us a few years ago called No Tender Mercies, which was on prison, his life in prison. He doesn't always write on prison issues, but he does sometimes. I want to just read a couple paragraphs from one part of his article. He says, "You can only tolerate so much abuse before the survival instinct demands an end to pain and mistreatment. All too often, prisoners, staggering under the burden of brutality, respond violently against the violence heaped upon bodies, mind, and soul. And all too often, that's just what our keepers hope we'll do. It justifies their hollow claims that we are little better than animals, deserving no better treatment than beasts. Somehow that warped logic has even become the common belief of many people who are demanding and getting still longer, still harsher sentences for even minor violations of the law. More and more, these same people staunchly support the ultimate barbarity, death at the hands of the state." Alice Miller says, quote, "When a person cannot talk about the cruelty endured as a child because it was experienced so early that it is beyond the reach of memory, then he or she must demonstrate cruelty," unquote. I cannot help but wonder at the degree of cruelty our keepers must have experienced, a cruelty which drives them to perpetuate similar acts today and every day. A long time ago, an old cynical warden had me brought to his office, naked and shackled, to stand before him in a room full of other keepers. That old man spent considerable time telling me how worthless he thought I was, and how it would be, quote, a damn shame, unquote, if something unforeseen happened to me, quote, after all you put your mama through by going to death row. His attempted intimidation sprang from a need to shut me up, to force me through violence and threats of more violence, to stop writing about the conditions of prison life in Texas. At the time, it seemed like something out of a very bad movie, and it still does. But I knew then, as I know now, that there is no choice of shutting up, of not speaking the truth, of sharing the reality of this place, no matter how unreal it becomes. One must risk evil by calling evil its name. Prisons are not a pretty place. Some are run better than others, but there are an awful lot in which there is an awful lot of cruelty. And so we have a mixture of a high percentage of our people going to prison. We have it unfairly used against the people who have the least power and status in our society. And we have them enduring much sorrow and abuse when they get there. Now I want to, before we go on, have a little game. Doesn't seem like a subject we're going to game about, but let's have a little game. Take a piece of paper, and you're going to need a pencil or pen, and I have some here for someone here. You don't have one, but I want these back, please. Yes.
What kind of we have seen major changes as far as the reform over the last 50 years of prisons? Now you gave us numbers of people incarcerated, but are we seeing improvements in the the system at all?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the system.
I guess
in the conditions?
In the conditions and the treatment of people.
Oh, in some places, yes. Okay, now, does everyone have a piece of paper? Because I want us all to start. We're going to all be ready to write. This is a timed experiment. Anybody still lacking something? Okay. Too broad a question. Okay, now, I'm going to give you 60 seconds, okay? From the time that I say go. I want you to list on a piece of paper as many people as you can think of from the Bible who were in prison or some kind of confinement. You know, dungeons, pits, those things are prisons too. Pits count. Confinement is what we're talking about. Prisons, confinement, anything like that. As many as you can put down. Don't start writing until I say go. Whoever comes up with the longest list is the winner. Okay, go. Seconds is up. Okay, now I'm sure that if I'd given you a longer time, some of you would have come up with more. How many came up with 10 or more? One? Two? Three? Okay. How many did you each come up with?
Ten?
Eight. Well, I said all the 12 disciples, so that adds...
Okay, all right.
I said all the Israelites in Babylon.
Okay, she
Okay.
I didn't really write that down.
All right.
I thought about it.
Though. You thought about it. Okay. Well, and who else had more than 10?
I had 10.
You had 10. Okay. And
because I think one, I had 11, but I think one is wrong.
Uh-huh.
I've got 10 plus this.
Plus call. That. Okay. All right. Well, some of you that have a fairly long list, one of you, Barb, why don't you start? Read your list for us, and let's hear some of the names.
Well, I started with the psalmist.
The psalmist.
All those kids. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Niemeyer, I'm in a pit.
Okay.
Jeremiah. John the Baptist, mm-hmm. Jesus, Daniel, mm-hmm. Then I did go with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, all of them. Joseph and Paul.
Uh-huh, okay. All right. Gretchen, do you have some
I
others?
I had Moses, mm-hmm. all those and Paul.
Uh-huh, okay, mm-hmm. All right. Who else had some other names?
Daniel?
Yeah, Daniel.
Well, I think Barbara. Ben's count.
Samson. Yeah.
Samson, yes.
Uh-huh.
Stephen, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Timothy,
uh-huh. Adam and Eve.
Yeah, I put Adam and Eve. Timothy was
too. Oh, that's kind of stretching it. That's kind of stretching it. Okay, did anyone have anything else?
David,
uh-huh.
I had David, I wasn't sure if that was right.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Okay.
Was Timothy in prison? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think with Paul.
Okay.
Yes, uh-huh, okay. Okay, there are actually a lot more. But those are probably the most notable ones. Now, think about the list that you had, and the other names that were mentioned. As you read those stories in the Bible, on whose side are you usually on? Whose side do you feel drawn to? The imprisoners or the imprisoned?
The victim.
The victim, meaning the one who's in prison?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's the way it usually, that's how I feel usually. I think that's how the stories are written, really. Is there any sense of whose side God is on? It's on the people who are imprisoned. Can you think of any situations in Scripture in which God seems to be on the side of those who are putting people in prison?
Leviticus?
Where?
Well, it seems like there's orders to stone people. Okay, it's capital
people.
Punishment. It's not imprisonment, it's killed.
No, there is no provision for imprisonment in the Old Testament.
The only one I had any different feeling about was Barabbas.
Barabbas.
Oh, yeah. That's the only one I had different feeling. I still wasn't on the side of the jailer.
There are, many people would say, no passages in Scripture that seem to be siding with the imprisoned person or advocating imprisonment. One possible exception is in 2 Samuel, in which there's a situation where David leaves 10 concubines in charge of the palace, and they don't do what he felt was right, and he comes back and he throws them all into some kind of confinement for the rest of their lives, and they die there. It's a rather obscure story. We don't tell it very often. But it's even questionable then on really whether that is to be viewed positively or negatively. There are, on the other hand, a host of verses in which God is portrayed as being on the side of those who are confined, imprisoned, or in otherwise some kind of captivity. The list I put up here is the sampling of some of those verses. And in none of those verses are there ever any conditions mentioned for God's siding with prisoners or wanting to set prisoners free. It's very interesting. There's just no conditions mentioned. I'm just going to mention at this point this book, which I have found very interesting and still absorbing. It's called The Religion of the Landless. I think it's a fascinating book, and it's by, Smith. I forget what his first name is. Daniel Smith. And it's attempting to look at the theology that developed during the time of the exile. And it's really seeing rather radical dimensions to that and trying to make applications to contemporary situations as well. And he too talks about what a strong, particularly during the time of the exile, what a strong resistance to the idea of prisons was developing among God's people. And even suggests that some of the earlier stories were enhanced in terms of their anti-prison feel during that time because they felt so much like the whole people was in prison that they really began to recover some of those stories about Joseph and so forth that really galled them. I think that for me, seeing that kind of biblical witness and seeing the quantity of text in which God is repeatedly described as being in favor of and working for the release of prisoners, I can't help but come to the conclusion that every prison is a sin and every cell is a crime. And because it seems to me that never, ever in any part of the Bible are prisons part of God's way. You know, we can debate about capital punishment because, well, there in Leviticus, all these things about stoning people, you know, what does that really mean? And, you know, does that apply to us? But you can't find anywhere in the Bible where it says to imprison people. And it seems to me that prisons are always used to oppress. They're always an affront to the divine. I would say, and I know that most of society and maybe most of you would disagree, but there simply are no good prisons. And they are always being used to crush people that we want to get rid of, that we want to destroy. I don't deny that there's crime. There's crime and there's suffering and there's victims of crime. And I want to talk a little bit more about that in my session on Saturday. But both Old and New Testaments continually portray God as the God who frees prisoners, who releases captives, who destroys cells. And Jesus, in proclaiming the acceptable year of the Lord in Luke 4, seems to call for a new jubilee, a jubilee that should extend to the jailed as well as to the unjailed. And that jubilee, grounded in an Old Testament vision, involved the freeing of all who are behind bars. No exceptions are mentioned. All prisoners set free. The epistles called on Christians to visit those in prison and seem to recognize that prisons are still with us. But visiting the imprisoned is, you know, it's regularly connected with other commands to help widows and the orphans and those who are hungry and abandoned. It seems to be that we are to be on the side of the imprisoned for the same reasons that we are to be on the side of the economically abandoned, the hungry, and the weak. Because, in the viewpoint of Scripture, people who are in prison are suffering unjustly. The weak, the hungry, the naked, that's not portrayed as something that was deserved. We're to be on their side because that's undeserved. And it seems like when we're commanded to visit those in prison, we're also commanded to minister to those who are suffering unjustly. Jesus said that when we champion the cause of the imprisoned in Matthew 25, that we champion him. We may think it is drug dealers and murderers and rapists whom we're throwing into our prisons. We may think it is only those of no value that we have. But we fool ourselves, says Jesus, for it is Jesus himself who sits behind those bars. And it is the tragedy of tragedies, God's own self, that we lock away. It's no wonder that prisons really do no good. Because the fact is, the more cells we build and the more people we lock away, the less of God we have in our society. Drugs are an abominable slavery, an exploitation usually, I think, of the rich on the poor. But the more drug dealers we've thrown in prison, it seems like the worse the problem has become. We haven't really solved the problem with that. And even as imprisonment goes up, crime rates go up. Maybe it's because prisons themselves are a crime. They solve nothing. They're just a godless perversion of utmost degradation. And the more we use them, the deeper we push ourselves into sin, the more tolerance we show for Satan's way, and the more we set loose the very forces we need to control. Maybe I'm going to take a moment here to talk about. Let's see, about justice. Because some folks say, well, you know, we just have to have prisons as part of our commitment to justice because there are people that are doing wrong to others, and how are we going to stop that, and so forth. I think we have different views sometimes of what justice is, and you know, there are various views that I think I've heard people express about what justice is. There are those who say, "Well, it's." I'm going to use the other marker here. it should be fairness. You know, each according to their deserving. Some people just deserve to be sent to prison. Or it's equality, treating everyone the same. If we could make all the sentences the same, you know, that would make it fair. That would make it just. Others talk about the need for blind justice, you know. The problem is we don't have blind justice. Justice is sometimes seen as the law of the land. We have to uphold the law of the land. Sometimes justice is just seen as, well, this is the workings of government. It's what we need for a society here. But I think that we have too often bought a very secular view of justice and not really learned from the gospel view of justice, in which fairness, that's not justice. Grace is justice. Not to each according to what they deserve, but each according to what they don't deserve. Not equality, but a reversal of roles in which the last become first and the first become last. Not blind justice, but open eyes, seeing the suffering and seeing what we're doing. Not the law of the land, but the way of God. And not the workings of government, but the law of love. Some folks who work with Indians in the mountains of Peru were visiting us recently. And we were talking about The Other Side magazine, which is so much focused on justice. And in fact, we've had a little slogan since our early years, justice rooted in discipleship. And they were saying how among the Indians of Peru, who have really very little power in that society and who feel very oppressed, missionaries have a terrible time even bringing up the word justice. Because justice to the Indians is the scariest thing that they can imagine. Because they know only secular justice. And justice on a secular level gets defined as the powerful against the unpowerful. And so justice is just an obnoxious concept to them. You're going to get justice, that means you're going to get it. But in the Bible, it seems to me God's justice is always a saving justice. It's not an oppressing justice, it's a saving justice. And I just think that sometimes we try to make these distinctions between love and justice. Love is what we do personally with others, and justice is what the state does. But any justice that's not grounded in love is not gospel justice. And that's the only justice that I think we're called to. I have a quote here that I'd like to read from an article that's going to be on The Other Side this fall. It's an article by Dan Berrigan, who's seen courts and jails firsthand a lot of times, and I'm sure that colors his understandings. He's writing in this article about the book of Daniel, and he refers to King Darius. Daniel has gone up to his room to pray, and there is the law that you weren't to pray. And so he's brought before the king, and the king is immensely distressed because this is someone he's really favored and appreciated and liked. And yet the king is reminded that, you know, no law that you've put down can be changed. And the law was that they're thrown into the den of lions. The king weeps in distress and yet is reminded that he's got to do it. He's got to throw him in there. So I'm just going to pick up a couple paragraphs here, and I hope that I'm not giving the lead into this. It might be a little awkward, but let me just read what he has to say. It says that we hear the king's echo in the throat of judges time and again. We hear it as well in the words of formerly good people, African Americans and others, now running for governorships and other high offices, vowing to carry out the very death sentences that they once knew deep in their own hearts were utterly and totally devoid of moral integrity. It is a plea, a guilty plea most pitiful. I must uphold my oath of office. Thus are judges and elected officials far too often brought to wicked deeds. To whom are they indebted? The question is impertinent, so it must be posed. They are indebted to the gods that fill their sails with winds. The winds have a voice. They are daemons of suggestion, betrayers. Judges, what a profession they have chosen. At the behest of the principalities, judges must be willing to declare white black and black white. They must render the ungodly godly. This is the law they are sworn to honor, the law of the land, the only law, the supreme law, the law outlawing all other law. Speak not of conscience. Summon not your biblical word. Presume not to invoke the law of the nations. Out of order, irrelevant, speak of no tradition, no font of divine light or human. This is the law. You stand in the dock, an entity of two dimensions only, in this time, in this nation. The two frame you in more senses than one. The two judge you, which is to say they destroy you or declare you immaculate. The law of citizens is your damnation, your only savior. The law, the word itself is like an impermeable enclosure, a prison thrust upon us. It sets limits, lays heavy claim, it exhausts reality. The human itself cannot be otherwise, other where, other when understood. He suggests in his article that in many ways we've made an idol out of our laws sometimes. Idols and laws that in our society keep throwing more and more people into prison without upholding the value of people that Jesus seemed to call us to. And there is, I think maybe some of you know of a writer, a theologian named Will Campbell. He's a Southern Baptist. And Southern Baptists have been becoming increasingly conservative and fundamentalist. And they keep clearing out of their ranks people who don't believe in the literal inerrancy of Scripture and that sort of thing. And Will Campbell, he's kind of celebrating that fact. He's just delighted that that Southern Baptists are not going to take the Bible seriously, and he suggested recently that all 12 million or 23 million or whatever number there are is Southern Baptists who take the Bible seriously. He suggested that they all join him, and he gave a time and he gave the date, and they join him there at the gates of the Tennessee State Prison, and. And he expressed the confidence that if they all worked together, quote, they could raise that sucker in no time flat. unfortunately, no one showed up except him. And I wonder how are we gonna deal with this society that just keeps building more and more prisons. Keeps putting more and more people, the people that we want to get rid of, destroy, behind bars. We have now a situation where for every 100 black women of traditional marrying age, there are only 44 eligible African-American men who are not behind bars or dead. We are destroying people. We are destroying families. We are destroying cultures. And maybe we've always done this to our minorities, but it's an awful thing. And what thoughts, what ideas do you have? Shall we all set dates in which we all gather around the prisons and get enough of us there and see that they're destroyed? Or is there something else we can do too?
Don't you think we should work on the alternative? I mean, these okay. people have hurt people outside. And mm-hmm. I see. I know what you're saying, that, mm-hmm. but there, we should be working at what we're going to, how we're going to help these people mm-hmm. before. Seems like abolish mm-hmm. all the prisons first is kind of
the
cart before the
horse. Right. Well, that, you know, that's what people have been saying, and there's a lot of legitimacy to that. My frustration is that we don't seem to be making much progress on that, and there's not really any motivation to it as long as we got the prisons. Some states have had a little bit of movement in the right direction simply because they're running out of prison space. If we started getting rid of some of these prisons, I think there'd be even more motivation. We'd get those programs developed fast.
Yeah. I think, though, that if you go to the prison, there won't be any more show up than we did with Campbell to carry on.
What's that?
I say if you go to the prison and invite us all to come to, there won't be any more there than Campbell, mm-hmm. all of the Southern mm-hmm. Baptists. Mm-hmm. So, our conversation is that at least I believe you could turn half of them loose. I have no kind of questions at all with that, and wouldn't have to put them on parole or anything. And it would end the difficulty. It's probably higher than that. But I think if we're going to do something, we've got to figure out a way to really get something that will move. Now, most of the people say that we're going to run at the end of this when we run out of money. But I'm not confident in that we're going to run out of money. Because one of the things that happens when a community gets a prison, then they want to keep it full so they can keep getting the money mm-hmm. in there, so mm-hmm. they're going for appropriations. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen anybody say close this prison down once they get it. Mm-hmm. They don't want it there in the first place. Mm-hmm. But I don't know any other way mm-hmm. than alternative ways of doing it, meaning that we start taking responsibility of the community, and at least for a period of time in Minnesota, we did do that. And I know the pressure now is going toward expansion of prisons in Minnesota, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But we did have some community programs that did have some success to it.
What were they? I don't understand what alternatives
would be. Well, give you an example. In the pork program in Rochester, one of the key things is they wouldn't take from other places because you have to have community responsibility. They had a person who was a psychologist, a person who was an educator, a person who was in one of the corporations in the town, the three people. And then, so you'd have contact for jobs, contact for learning skills by the people, and then a person who could understand what was going on, and they had the hope. And then the people who were residents, rather than they call them prison, all had a voice in this, and they made the determination of when you're ready to go out and you start getting jobs and held responsible, sort of, in a way, a larger household, like Dan was talking about here in that town. An operation. Mm-hmm. That seemed to me to have some hope to it.
And they were sentenced to
it? They were sentenced to it, yeah. And for a while, there, it isn't the case now, the judges in Rochester and Olmsted County were sending nobody to prison. They went there, I think, about 3 years. Absolutely nobody was sent to prison. And even a person who could have had that person sent to prison because it was armed robbery against them chose the opponent accepting the rule. So that's mm-hmm. If there was a way, Mark, mm-hmm. that we could abolish prison, because I absolutely agree with you, there's no place in history that shows that prisons were successful at rehabilitating mm-hmm. anybody. So it's an absolute failure mm-hmm. that we could do it, but I don't know how we're going to get to that, mm-hmm. that step. I wouldn't even show up over there with you because it's so impossible. I wouldn't have the guts to go do that.
But you know, I think one thing that we have to do is we have a society that is politicians and and common folks and the media and everything is promoting the idea of we've got to have more prisons, more prisons, more prisons, more prisons. And this is absolutely contrary to what Christians should be calling for. And we've got to start in our churches and in our communities and among our friends speaking the biblical message that Psalm 146, the Lord sets prisoners free. Psalm 102, the Lord hears the groans of prisoners and releases those condemned to death. We've got to start talking about the fact that the Bible is not in favor of prisons, about the fact that prisons don't even do any good on a just purely objective basis. I mean, they don't solve the problem. And start really trying to promote some values that are a little bit more biblical, a little bit more Christian, and start saying, no, I'm not, I know for myself, I don't vote for any politician that is in favor of building another prison or putting anybody to death. Now, half the time, more than half the time, I don't have anybody to vote for. And I don't vote, and I'm not going to vote for another person that's in favor of putting anybody in prison. And if all Christians, if we started saying, no, that this is a fundamental sin in our society, we are not going to do this anymore, we would gradually begin to change at least the awareness and the values. And, you know, we might not totally get rid of prisons, but we would start putting a stop to some of this, and we'd be the kind of witness, I think, that Christ tried to send us into the world to be, witnesses to what God is about. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, in the old days, people were more accountable to the communities.
Mm-hmm.
If you did something wrong, you were put in the middle of the town and you were left to be dealt with by the community. Mm-hmm. They all looked at you, and mm-hmm. by putting our prisoners locked up where nobody could look at them, we don't get to see a sort of mirror ourselves mm-hmm. in those prisoners, and they also mm-hmm. don't get to look at people that they harm.
Yeah. I think, though, there's another thing that we wouldn't just see a mirror of ourselves. We would see that it's not the majority that's represented in prison in the sense that same proportions. Sometimes I think that the reason that some of those other industrialized countries that I cited, Austria, West Germany, whatever, have fewer people in prison proportionately, so they have fewer minorities. Mm-hmm. Prisons are part of how we deal with the people that we don't like. And it's not just criminals. I mean, there's a whole intermixing of the economic and political conditions and plus the violence in our hearts that gets all mixed up in it. But we push people who are on the margins into desperate situations and into violent situations, and then we lock them away. And I'm not sure we didn't want to push them there to start with so that we could lock them away.
I guess I think of it more as this is such an unusual experiment in America that so many different kinds of people mm-hmm. have come here from. Mm-hmm. So many different mm-hmm. cultures and, different mm-hmm. kinds of laws and different mm-hmm. senses of what's right and wrong mm-hmm. and everything else. So mm-hmm. that whatever kind of success we've had is really kind of incredible because mm-hmm. none of those other countries, they're all mm-hmm. homogeneous.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, we've forcibly taken this land to start with. So we're sort of I think those of us who are in the majority here, it's all of us in this room, I think, we're kind of in a tenuous place. And I think...
we've actually tried the experiment a little bit in terms of mental institutions. Mm-hmm. If you think about, for instance, I mean, it would be interesting to do a follow-up of what's happened now that so many people mm-hmm. have no longer been able to be locked away because they've been committed for some version of a mental problem. One of the most obvious cases where it's made a huge difference is with Down syndrome children. It wasn't so long ago that most of those children were put away for life. And now, the great majority of them are actually raised by family, reintegrated into the community, can live And not just, I mean, but that's one that is a very clear case. I don't even know the story of the rest, but it would be worth finding out.
Yeah.
What?
You put them out in the community and forgotten them.
What's that?
Isn't that we put them out there now, the better off and the awful out of them are even worse off.
And unfortunately, when you're talking about the homeless, many of the shelters we create are run like prisons. There is a shelter in the town where I live that is absolutely awful. In fact, I've stopped volunteering there because I cannot stand it. But the people that run it regularly talk about the people who are spending the night for whom there should be extending hospitality as inmates. I mean, this is just a shelter for the homeless. They talk about them as inmates. We have all kinds of hidden prisons in our society as well.
There is a move, and I don't know exactly what it is, where they're trying to bring the person who committed a crime together with the person who had been victimized by the crime, even to the point of somebody who's committed, murdered some close relative, and they found that extremely successful, because then we get into the idea of restitution.
Yeah.
And restitution to the people that are hurt, not this lockaway thing.
Oh, right. Yeah. But see, I don't think our society is really out to do restitution. It would be wonderful if we were. We're just out to get rid of some people.
To punish them.
And we're going to talk more about crime and some of those things on Saturday.
Mark, you know, I find it interesting that the largest number of people I run across who state like you that it's a failure of the prison system are wardens. And I once talked to a couple of them and said, why don't you get, sheriffs run jail, why don't you get together when you're retired, get all the formal ones who feel that now they can express themselves and start a campaign against prisons. Yeah. But nothing's happened.
And you know, I wonder if you were a warden and if you were a Christian and you'd come to that conclusion and you'd come to the conclusion that the Bible is talking about all the time, but God freeing the prisoners, what would you do? Would any of us have the courage to just open the doors someday? Let them go?
How about these?
I think maybe that's what we need.
How about these boot camps that they're setting up that are an alternative to...
Right. And the initial evidence is that they do absolutely no better whatsoever, and they just terrorize people incredibly.
What is that?
These boot camp kind of things that are set up.
But what they take is people who would have gone on probation and put them in the boot camp rather than people who would have gone to prison. And so, because the best results are probation.
Yeah. But even the boot camps are not showing any different recidivism rate.
No.
It's just punishing people more.
It's
really what it turns out to be.
If you compare where they would have been if they hadn't gone to boot camp in Boston, it's worse recidivism than it would have been where they were. That was the latest thing. Yeah.
Okay. We have run out of time here, and so we need to close. When you think, I just want to close with this. I have a wonderful church, and it's got a lot of wonderful choirs. And there's one of our choirs that loves to process in when it's singing at a service. It sings this song. It's a simple little song. And the verses go, I'll say yes, oh yes, to your will and to your way. I'll say yes, oh yes, I will trust you and obey. When your spirit speaks to me, with my whole heart, I'll agree. And the answer will be yes, oh yes. And they sing that and they march in and they march around and they sing it again and again and again. I know, 25, 30 times. I'll say yes, oh yes, to your will and to your way. And they sing it until it penetrates their souls, until you can't help but say yes, oh yes, to God's will and to God's way. And I think that when it comes to prisons or any of these other issues, we have to just keep reminding ourselves and letting it sink into our souls that what Jesus is calling us to is to say yes, oh yes, to God's will and to God's way. And start with saying yes and not start with well, we've got to think about this, we've got to think about this. We start by saying yes, then we start by thinking about the other things and how we're going to do it. But we've got to have our fundamental commitments and our fundamental values right before we'll get anywhere. Okay, thank you. If any of you want a little subscription form for the other side, I have some here.